Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I'd like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like now to turn the conference over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for this monthly climate update call. And this is part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, my name is Brady Phillips. I'm a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. So today we'll have three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. And today we'll be following along with a presentation that can be found online at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings, B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S, and it should have the date of August 18th on it. Our first presenter today is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at the Climate Monitoring Branch in NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina. We'll provide a summary of the July U.S. and global climate reports. And our next presenter will be Jessica Baccio, a climatologist at Cornell University and the Northeast Regional Climate Center. We'll discuss the developing drought conditions and related impacts in the northeastern United States. And our final presenter will be Anthony Artusa, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center's Operational Prediction Branch in College Park, Maryland. We'll provide us a La Nina update, as well as a monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the coming 3 months. We'll now begin with Jake Crouch from NCEI. Jake?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm going to start off talking to slide number 2 on the slide deck you can download from our website. Looking at our global report that came out yesterday, July 2016 had a globally average temperature that was 0.87 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average. This marks the warmest July on record, the 15th consecutive month that we've seen record warm temperatures for the globe. And taking climatology into account, with July typically being the warmest month of the year, July 2016 was the warmest month we have observed in our period of record that dates back to 1880. When you break it down and look at land and ocean surfaces separately, the land surface of the globe tied 1998 as the warmest July on record, and the ocean surface was record warm for the month as well. The graphic on the right breaks down these temperatures across the globe. Areas that are highlighted in the darkest red were record warm. The next shade of red, top 10% for that location for the month of July. So we can see that much of the global surface was either record warm or much warmer than average. A couple of hot spots during the month, much of the eastern Indian Ocean stretching across Indonesia, a large section of the West Pacific, and also a section in the southeast Atlantic off the east coast of the United States. This is important as we move into the most active part of the North Atlantic hurricane season. There were a couple parts of the globe that were cooler than average, including parts of Siberia, as well as parts of the southern oceans off of the coast of Antarctica. Just to mention a few locations, Hong Kong tied its warmest July on record. Bahrain also tied its warmest July on record. And a temperature in Mitraba, Kuwait, on July 22nd reached 126.5 degrees Fahrenheit, according to an observation taken by the United States Air Force. That could be, if it's confirmed, would be the highest temperature ever observed in Asia and the highest temperature ever observed in the Eastern Hemisphere. Moving on to slide number 3 to look at how temperatures have evolved 2016 compared to the previous years. As we move left to right along each line, that shows how the year-to-date temperature has evolved for 2016 compared to the other 8 top warmest years for the globe. As we can see, 2016, we started off the year really warm, and as the El Nino waned and we moved into neutral El Nino conditions, we've seen the global temperature approach what we observed in 2015, but we're still quite a bit above where we were at this point last year. The globally average temperature for the January through July period was 1.03 degrees above the 20th century average. Looking at scenarios for the rest of the year, the remaining 5 months of 2016 would have to tie 1998 for the year not to be record warm. So that means we would have to drop out of the top 15 in terms of global temperatures for the next several months, which is highly unlikely, which conversely means that 2016 is very likely to be the warmest year on record for the globe. Moving on to number four to talk about what happened here in the U.S. It was warmer than average across the contiguous U.S. as a whole, the 14th warmest July on record. A lot of that warmth was situated across the southern U.S. and along the East Coast. New Mexico and Florida were both record warm, with much warmer than average conditions across the southwest, southern plains, southeast, and stretching into the northeast. Looking at precipitation, there were a couple of really dry spots and a couple of really wet spots. And when we average across the nation, it was near average for the month as a whole in terms of precipitation totals. Some of the wetter than average places, western Kentucky was particularly wet, where significant flooding was observed, and parts of the state observed more than 16 inches of rainfall. And we can see the warm and dry conditions in the Northeast that has contributed to worsening drought conditions there, which Jessica will speak to in detail in a moment. Looking at the first 7 months of 2016 here in the contiguous U.S., the graphic on the left shows a 5-kilometer gridded temperature data set comparing each grid point's temperature for the first 7 months of the year to the 20th century average. We can see that almost the entire contiguous U.S. was warmer than average for 2016 so far, with a lot of that warmth situated across the northern tier and in the west. So the first 7 months of 2016 have ranked as the third warmest on record, with only 2012 and 2006 being warmer than this year at this point in the year. And also Alaska continues to be record warm for 2016 so far. Moving on to slide number six, to look at the U.S. Drought Monitor report that came out this morning. 19.9% of the contiguous U.S. is in drought. That's up about 2% since early July, but actually down slightly compared to the last couple of weeks. We did see drought improve across parts of the parts of the Midwest and the southeast. In parts of the southeast where it didn't rain, we did see drought worsening. We saw drought conditions also worsen in the northern plains and Rockies, southern plains, as well as the northeast. And outside of the United States, Tropical Storm Darby made landfall on Hawaii, which brought heavy rainfall and helped alleviate drought conditions there. With that, I will pass it off to Jessica.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jessica. So I will start with slide seven. Here we're looking at talking about drought in the northeast United States. So the map here is showing percent of normal precipitation from March 1st through August 16th. So majority of the region has been in a precipitation deficit since March. So now we're going on 6 months of deficit, which would be considered long-term in drought standards. And you can see the dark orange on the map are areas that have had less than 75% of their normal precipitation. That's covering areas in western New York, central Pennsylvania, parts of northern New Jersey, into Connecticut, Massachusetts, southern New Hampshire, and parts of Maine. There's been record low precipitation during this time period, so March 1st, August 16th. At a few stations I selected here, Geneva, New York, has had 7.69 inches of precipitation. That's only 45% of their normal amount of 17.09 inches. Lawrence, Massachusetts has also had a low amount, only 46% of their normal. They've had 10.71 inches, where they're normally by this point have 23.2 inches of precipitation. Several other New York stations, Elmira, Avon, Lowville, have also had record low precipitation during this time period. And these are just a sampling of stations, not necessarily an exhaustive list, but just to give you an idea of some of the records that we've seen. Moving on to slide eight, we're looking at summer to date precipitation. We see the map here of percent of normal for June 1st through August 16th, so this is climatological summer. The map does look a bit different. You'll see some shades of green, more shades of green on this map. The dark green is more than the dark green is more than 150% of normal. You see areas of that down in West Virginia, a little bit area in Maryland. Both of those actually had some record-setting rainfalls during June and July. So there was some improvement in their precipitation conditions. You can see kind of more normal conditions in eastern parts of New York. So that has been beneficial, but other areas you see are still in the less than 75% of normal in that dark orange. There's also now some dark red, and that's less than 50% of normal. There's a few spots there in western New York. Also, if you look in the eastern parts of the region, in Massachusetts and in southern New Hampshire, some areas there have had that less than 50% of precipitation. Some record lows during this time period, so summer to date, Boston, Massachusetts has had just over 3 inches of rain. That's only 34% of their normal for this time period. Geneva, New York, also having record low precipitation, 3.26 inches, where they normally had over 8.5 inches by this point. And Walpole, Massachusetts, another station that we pulled, has not quite 4 inches, and that's only 39% of our normal. So, again, we're seeing some records breaking for this low precipitation levels. We move on to slide 9. See in the lower left-hand corner today's updated drought monitor map focusing in on the northeast region. And then on the right is a total precipitation map for the last week, August 10th through 16th. So you can see that there has been some more rain in this last week. The dark green areas have had more than 3 inches of rain. So you can see that in extreme southwest New York and extreme south Northwest Pennsylvania, some other kind of scattered spots of precipitation. So there has been some improvement in those areas. They've kept conditions from worsening, and there's been even some one category improvement in some of those areas. But you'll also see a lot of still red on the map, or just only about an inch or so of rain, and which just isn't enough to alleviate the drought conditions that we've seen. So there's been an increase in the extreme drought. So that's in the drought monitor map, that's the red. We've seen an increase in expansion in Massachusetts, and that's gone also into New Hampshire. And there's two new areas in New York, in western New York along the I-90 corridor and also along the southern Finger Lakes region. If we move on to slide 10, we'll talk about some of the impacts. One, of course, is below normal stream flow. The map there is a USGS 7-day stream flow map. We can see the orange dots, there is below normal stream flow. The burgundy red dots are much below normal, and the bright red are very low stream flows. There has been some rebound where the rain has fallen. We can see those kind of green and blue dots, but there's still a lot of the very low stream flow, especially where we see the extreme drought on the drought monitor map. Other impacts we've seen are low wells and low reservoir levels. Some wells in Genesee County, New York, have gone dry or have very low water pressure. There's been wildlife and recreation impacted. Some anglers have been asked to reduce their fishing in certain areas because the fish are being stressed by the low water levels. There's also been an effect on marinas and boaters because of the low water levels. There's been an increased fire risk, and fire bans have been enacted in certain areas. And there's been many state declarations of drought watches, advisories, and warnings across the region. Massachusetts has increased to a drought warning in central and northeast Massachusetts. New York, the western half of the state, is in a warning. And New Hampshire has water use restrictions and some outdoor bans. And other states have also enacted some of these as well. And there's been many agricultural impacts, especially in many of these rural areas that have large agriculture communities. There's been a lot of corn loss. Some of it's been a complete loss, where they've had to claim their crop insurance. There's been an alfalfa and pumpkins. Soybeans, some of them there's still some hope for. Others are so low that they're actually cutting them for forage. There's been low hay yields. And there's been increased risk for combine and tractor fires because of the dry conditions in the fields, and shallow livestock ponds are just some of the impacts that we're seeing here in the Northeast. That concludes my slides, and I will now pass it on to Anthony.
Thank you very much, Jessica, and good morning, everyone. I'd like to go on to slide 11, and here we're going to take a look at the sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific and also the impacts on the El Nino Southern Oscillation. Okay, first, if we look at the map in the upper left, we can see the latest departures from normal for the sea surface temperatures. The blue shading represents where the sea surface temperatures are running generally 1 to 2 degrees Celsius below normal. So you can see that across the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. We also have above normal SSTs or sea surface temperatures off the coast of Southern California and Baja. And also, although you don't see it on this particular slide, we have a lot of above normal SSTs right around Alaska. Currently, we have a La Nina watch in place. So looking at the ENSO forecast, if we look at the bar graph at the lower left, you'll see this is a probabilistic forecast for what we think will happen for the next, say, 6 to 7 months. And the blue bars that you see represent the odds for a La Nina. So you can see that early on they're fairly low. It looks like they climb higher with time. And you can see that it peaks right around NDJ, which is the November, December, January season, before tapering off and going back down throughout the rest of the winter months. You'll also notice that the green bars are representative of neutral ENSO conditions. That simply means that it's not La Nina and not El Nino. It's somewhere right in between. Notice that that is what we are in right now. It's ENSO neutral phase. And you can see that with time, the green bars are decreasing, meaning the odds are also decreasing, and then they go back up again during the later winter and spring months. You'll also notice that the red bars, which are indicative of El Nino or a warm event, are basically insignificant until perhaps the MAM or March, April, May spring season. So for right now, it looks like we're going to be working with either borderline La Nina conditions or very weak La Nina conditions. So it does not look like a moderate or strong La Nina at this time. If we advance one slide to number 12, we can see the monthly forecast that was issued for September. On the left, we have the temperature probability map. On the right, we have the precipitation. So these are all in anomalies, meaning the departures from normal. You can see if we start first over the CONUS or the contiguous U.S., above normal temperatures are favored, probabilities as high as 80% around parts of Idaho. We also have above normal temperatures favored across the Gulf Coast region and also across eastern New England. Up in Alaska, the entire state is expected to be above normal, with the highest probabilities of about 60% up on the North Slope and also 50 to 60% along the southern coast. Most of the rest of the country, we're going with EC, which represents equal chances of below normal, near normal, or above normal. So it's a way of saying that there is no discernible tilt in the odds towards any one category. So we don't know, we don't have enough information on which to base the forecast. So we have to default to EC. The precipitation forecast, on the right, you can see the green shading represents where we think the precipitation will be above normal. That includes the south coast of Alaska and also parts of Arizona and surrounding states. We also have below normal precipitation indicated across the Pacific Northwest and across much of the Gulf Coast states and up into the Tennessee Valley. Now, I might add that how these forecasts are generated are, there's really a few things that we use. One would include a number of so-called climate forecast models, which are involved dynamical models, which take into effect the interactions between the land, the ocean, the vegetation, the atmosphere, and sea ice. Another thing that we look at are the historic trends, both in temperature and precipitation. If we go on to the next slide, number 13, we'll see the seasonal forecast for September, October, November. Notice here for the temperature probability, we're going with above normal temperatures across the entire lower 48 states, also for Alaska. Across the CONUS or the contiguous U.S., notice that the highest probabilities range from, let's say, about 60% or more in parts of the Southwest, in excess of 50% along the Gulf Coast and New England. And then up in Alaska, we have two areas where the temperatures are expected to max out, in a sense, in terms of probabilities. and that would include the North Slope, where it's in excess of 70% for above, and in excess of 60% for parts of the South Coast. Incidentally, the 70% northern part of Alaska is largely tied to the climatologically delayed onset of sea ice across parts of the Beaufort Sea and the Arctic Ocean. This results in a delayed cooling overall since the ice has been delayed in setting up. For the precipitation, notice that we have the green shading. That represents the above normal precipitation across the northern plains and also across the Alaska Panhandle. For the below normal precipitation, we're expecting that over parts of the far west, including Nevada and parts of California, and also for a large fraction of the southeast, including the Tennessee Valley and the lower Mississippi Valley. And if we advance on to the next slide, which will be slide 14, I will say this is the current seasonal drought outlook, which is valid from today, August 18th, right through the end of November. You can see that where the brown shading is, these are the areas where we expect the current drought to persist or to linger. So you can see that it's across a large part of the west, also across much of the interior southeast and southern Appalachians, and then again across parts of the northeast. Where you see the yellow shading, that represents where we think drought is likely to develop, and that is mostly confined to the interior southeast. Where you see the tan shading, I can see that, for example, up in the northern plains. That represents the drought remaining but improving by at least one category according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. And finally, where you have the olive green shading, this is where we expect the drought removal to occur, meaning we go down to D0 or less on the drought monitor. For Alaska, we're not concerned really about any drought at this time, and the remaining areas of drought, both in Hawaii and also in Puerto Rico, expected to be removed as we move into this, what looks like a weak La Nina fall and winter season. So we expect the drought to be removed there. So that's all I had for now. I would like to turn it over back to Brady.
Thank you, Anthony. And we will now take specific questions from the call participants. Again, please be sure to indicate who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And operator, can you remind folks how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks.
Yes, thank you. We will now begin the questions and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It will take a few moments for the questions to come through. Please stand by. Our first question comes from Brian Sullivan. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. What kind of odds do you give for drought improvement in the Northeast? I mean, will the winter start to change things around, or we get into the fall and it starts to rain more, as it usually does, or is this going to be a prolonged drought in that area?
I think I can take that one. My name is Anthony, and according to the Northeast, the drought outlook that was issued yesterday, the various tools that we were looking at, a number of statistical and dynamical tools, did not show above normal precipitation either in the monthly or in the seasonal time periods. So for the time being, we think that the drought is likely to persist throughout this period, which covers the fall, although typically this begins to change toward the winter months. So as the conditions become cooler, the chances for the drought to increase or intensify become smaller and smaller, but we do think the drought is likely to at least persist, at least through November. I would think that the odds would start to increase for improvement during the winter months. But again, that extends a bit farther out than this forecast goes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jessica, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I would agree with that. That looking at the outlooks, that we really would need some above normal precipitation to take us out of the conditions that we're in. A lot of places really need several inches of rain, so not just normal precipitation, but above normal to get us out of these conditions. And we can hope that with winter and a change of weather patterns, that would bring some additional precipitation. But at this point, it does look like the conditions will persist through fall.
Great.
Brady, if I could just add one thing.
Sure.
That I was thinking of. This is Anthony. I noticed from the so-called AHAPS, or the Advanced Hydrologic Prediction System, that over the past 6 months, the precipitation deficits across parts of the Northeast have been around 8 inches or even more. So it's going to take some time to be able to erode those deficits.
How much time do you know?
That I don't know, but I would assume that if we can get a fairly healthy winter in terms of precipitation, that should make a very significant dent in it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe a lot of this drought is actually short-term, so the short-term drought would be overcome first. It's the longer-term drought that would probably take some time, some additional time to be overcome. That may take into the spring season.
And this is Jessica again, and I agree with what Anthony said. And some of the drought is we are starting to consider long-term. We are getting to the six-month time period when we look at deficits beginning in April and March. So some of the western New York and eastern Massachusetts are seeing some long-term drought starting to develop.
Our next question is from Andrea Thompson. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. I guess this would be for Jessica. I'm wondering how this drought in the Northeast compares to other historic droughts that we've had.
Okay, this is Jessica. And, we haven't seen this much extreme drought in the states that we're seeing it in quite a while, so it's not a common occurrence here in the Northeast. For example, New York hasn't been in a D3 extreme drought since the spring of 2002. So it has occurred before, but it's been a while. And Massachusetts and New Hampshire haven't seen this D3 extreme drought since the drought monitor began keeping track in 2000. So it's been even longer for those areas. So it isn't as common for us to see these extreme drought conditions.
Great. And I don't know if you could talk about, you're talking about how it might, how long it might take to erase these. We're not looking at a situation, like they have in California where it's years upon years. Like, we're likely probably within the next year or so to kind of at least make some of this up.
Yeah, and this is Jessica and yes, that's a great point to make. This is not a California drought that have gone on for years. This is much different here in the Northeast, where the droughts we see here are short-term. And even though we say long-term, we're talking, 6 months being long-term, we're still not talking, 4 or 5 years like they've seen out west. So this is definitely a different type of drought that we get here in the Northeast. And we should see, hopefully improvement within the next year. And it's likely that this drought will not last, beyond a year's term, just based on what we see historically here in the Northeast, without taking a forecast into consideration.
Great, thanks.
Yep.
This is Anthony. May I add something, Brady?
Sure.
Just a quick comment, alluding to what Jessica was saying, that the reason why the Northeast typically doesn't experience these long-term droughts like California does is frequently because the Northeast gets lots of frontal passages, warm fronts, cold fronts. It tends to be near the storm track where these low-pressure systems are moving more frequently, where California is different. So it's very difficult to get a long-established drought in the Northeast for those reasons.
Great, thanks.
Our next question is from Mike Cronin. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Mike Cronin from the Asheville Citizen Times. Thanks, Jake, Jessica, and Anthony. This is a question for Anthony. When you were talking about we're on a La Nina watch, if you could please define what that means for us, and also when and if La Nina hits. Right now it sounds like it will be a weak one. What does that mean for the U.S. contiguous states, and if you could talk specifically about the Southeast, that would be helpful.
Okay, thank you for your question. This is Anthony. A La Nina watch simply means that the conditions are favorable for a La Nina, a possible La Nina development within the next 6 months. We anticipate this La Nina to be very weak. Some of the very latest guidance was suggesting it would be borderline La Nina. Now, as you probably know, generally during a La Nina, the wet signal, the storm track, is generally up in the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies, and the dryness is usually found across the southern tier of states. That is what's typically expected in a, let's say, a moderate or a strong La Nina. In this case, the statistical relationships are not quite as strong, so it makes it more difficult to say with any confidence. But for right now, we at least have, for example, in the SON, or the September, October, November season, we're actually going with, pardon me one second, just trying to get my computer to act up here. For SON, we are going with the area of increased chances for below normal precip across the Southeast. That's because we are going with a weak La Nina. Now, should this back off into more of a neutral event, there is not really too much more we could say. We would have a larger coverage of EC or equal chances at that point.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, as a reminder, please press star 1 on your phone and record your name if you have a question. One moment, please. Our next question is from Greg Fischel. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if it'd be okay if I ask a question related to relating to climate change and evaluating data.
Yes, you can.
Okay. I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, and just out of interest the other day, I took a look at the number of 100-degree days that they've had since they started keeping records in 1944, and there have been 98, and over half of them have occurred since 1995. And it seems like it would be an easy correlation to make or causality to say that, okay, this is our local example of climate change. But then I also worry about the fact that the airport has undergone a lot of development in the last 20 years, a lot more buildings, a lot more tarmac, and that also the ASOS was installed at about that time. I think it was back in 94, 95. And so how do you I'm trying to be really, really careful. I fully accept the climate change science. I don't want to get into a situation where I assume causality without doing a thorough check to make sure that there aren't other factors at work. And I guess I'm looking for advice on how to do that.
Hi, Greg. This is Jake. So one of the things I might recommend is, you know, there has been development around the Raleigh airport over the past couple of decades. I was a resident of Raleigh for a while. You can look at some of the stations outside of that specific station. We do have that data available. And you can compare, a farm location, 30 miles away and look at how that temperature has changed over time compared to what has happened in Raleigh. But, overall, though, we are seeing an increase in these temperatures at both rural stations and urban stations. So it's consistent across the region, not just at one specific location. And so when we're talking about global climate change, looking at one station and how that's changed over time doesn't really answer the question of how fast is the climate changing. We have to look at a broader area. And so in what you're doing, I would recommend that. Look outside of the airport station.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Our next question is from Joel Witt. Go ahead. Your line is open. Joel, we're unable to hear you. Please press your unmute button.
Hi there. Sorry about that. Hi. Thanks for putting this on again on a monthly basis. This is great. Anthony, what are the dynamics that are missing in the ocean or atmosphere that are creating the La Nina situation?
Okay, this is Anthony. When you say that are missing, we have the La Nina, as I showed earlier, with the sea surface temperatures. If we go back to, I think it's slide 11, one of the key ingredients is not only the cold water at the surface, but also the depth of cold water in the subsurface structure. So for right now, although I don't have a map to show this, I can say that the below average heat content in the central and eastern Pacific extends down to about 150 to 200 meter depth, which is pretty deep. So that's a nice reservoir of relatively cold water. This particular La Nina may have started just a bit early, and it looks like it will peak perhaps in NDJ, November, December, January, or DJF, December, January, and February. So I think that, and we're also seeing some relatively warm water show up at shallower depths across the western Pacific. The question, to answer your question, is that right now we do have a good reservoir of subsurface cold water available to fuel this La Nina. The problem is we are not sure how long this is going to last and if it's going to be able to last long enough to carry throughout the winter season. So I think at this point, I think that's all we can really say about that, unless Brady or Jake, if you had any other ideas there.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, as a reminder, please press star 1 on your phone and record your name if you have a question. One moment, please. We show no further questions at this time.
Okay. Hi, this is Brady. This is last call for questions, and if somebody wants to press star 0 while I'm talking, we'll take the last question. Otherwise, I'm going to end by reminding you to mark your calendars for some upcoming releases. The next U.S. climate highlights for the month of August will be released on September 8th, and the next global climate highlights for the month of August will be released September 20th. So I do have that tentatively our calls are normally the third Thursday of the month, so that will be September 15th. In the interim, if you do have specific questions or need follow-up, please feel free to email me at Brady Phillips, that's Brady.Phillips at NOAA.gov, or John Leslie, and that's John.Leslie at NOAA.gov, and we'll be happy to see who we can get to help answer your questions. So again, thanks for your participation, and this concludes the call. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.